Dr. Trevor Norris is an associate professor in the Department of Graduate and Undergraduate Studies in Education at Brock University. And a lot of his research, well, I think it could be summed up in the names of the two books that we'll be talking about today on Niagara Voices and Views: Consuming Schools, Commercialism and the End of Politics, and a book that has just come out, Questioning the Classroom, Perspectives on Canadian Education. You can tell by those titles that this is undoubtedly going to be a conversation where we talk about some of the assumptions that happen in classroom spaces, and also the ways they've changed and are changing, and the roles that we have in that. The title of your book, Consuming Schools, Commercialism and the End of Politics, is a pretty provocative and a pretty interesting title. And the term consuming comes up in a number of other articles you've written that intersect with ideas of education, and of course also intersect with notions of philosophy, because that's also part of your area of expertise. And some of this comes back to an idea that one of the reviewers put out there, the idea of an engaged and critical citizenry. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what ideas you're presenting, why you think these are things that we should be talking about right now.
Well, that's a good question. I think consumerism has risen to a position of great dominance in our culture today, more so than any other historical period. And in part, in the beginning of the book, Consuming Schools, I trace, especially the 20th century, I trace the rise of consumerism and give some explanation for its character and also what led to it becoming so influential. Now, there's a lot of other features of consumerism that we can look at, ways of its impact on culture. I look more intensively at education, the way that, for example, advertising is influencing education today, the way that corporate sponsorship and commercial relationships between educational institutions and the private sector are impacting education. And one of the concerns I have regarding that pattern is that increasingly students now come to think of themselves as being consumers of education. And I think something really important is lost or compromised when we talk about education in that way. Now, one of the interesting ways that consumerism works is it's kind of imperialistic in a sense. It spreads throughout the culture, but it also spreads in the way that we talk and the way that we think, so that everything we do and say adopts or adapts the language of consumerism, whether it be in the healthcare sector. Sometimes patients are spoken of as consumers. Almost any context, we now think of ourselves as being consumers. For example, this way of talking about citizens as being taxpayers that's come up in the last decade or two is quite original and quite unique, and it's a real narrowing of politics, so that we don't think of ourselves being citizens of a political community. Instead, our relationship with each other and with our leaders or our organizing institutions is a consumer relationship, where we want to be sure that we get what we pay for and we get our money's worth from our taxes. Now, that's not to say that we should be not concerned about waste or inefficiency, but my concern is that when we think of ourselves being taxpayers or consumers, that displaces another type of identity that's very important, whether it be a citizen or a student. Now, when students think of themselves as being consumers, there's quite a bit that's lost in that process. For starters, it becomes a individualistic relationship. Consumers are primarily defined by the pursuit of rational self-interest. If you look at the way that this is spoken about in the economics literature, that we are motivated by rational self-interest or we're trying to maximize our utility, well, that kind of doesn't quite fit in the educational context. If education is primarily undertaken for rational self-interest, then we miss out on things like curiosity, relationships with others, or the idea that education happens in community and happens not just for me and my own personal gain, but happens with concern about some kind of public good. And that's another example of the language that we're losing today in our culture because of the focus on consumerism, is the idea of the public good being displaced by private good or private rational self-interest.
I understand what you mean in terms of it being more of a individual privileging. It kind of comes back to an idea that a colleague of yours at Brock talked about, with how we won't actually see genuine reduction or genuine steps taken in terms of something like climate change until such time as we stop consuming as much as we do, and how that's something that will require a sort of shift away from thinking just of what we want and thinking in a larger, more societal-oriented context. And it is also something, too, when you're talking about this in educational spaces, it seems like there's also a kind of dangerous element, or these are spaces where individuals are very malleable, and therefore this is where they form their thinking in terms of how they will go out into larger society. Part of your background as well is in terms of philosophy, so this is something where it's sort of gauging how an individual negotiates or actually sort of learns literally what their relationship with the larger society is. You raise a really interesting point in an article you wrote that's something that's very topical right now in terms of questions of the Canadian economy and talking about how the price of oil going down is affecting different things here. And this is something you talk about in terms of how we see society and how we see our relationship to society, or how I guess we're indoctrinating students, whether positively or negatively. And it's something you talk about in a really interesting article called Going with the Flow, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, that's another good point to elaborate on. Let me also just address a few other points you raised as well. The idea of individual solutions regarding things like climate change. I'm looking out my window right now here on Brock campus, and it's Monday around noon, and people are out in T-shirts, and it's February 1st. And as I was arriving on campus, I actually saw a person driving a convertible with the top down. So who would have believed that on February 1st we'd have this kind of situation? I sometimes wonder if people would be having a different outlook if the temperature was going in the opposite direction and it was getting colder and colder and the winters were longer and longer. Now, regarding how what we can do about this, the idea that there are individual solutions to these kind of larger political problems, I think, is a consumer mentality. We can certainly do our best in terms of reducing our individual consumption or using certain light bulbs and so on and so forth. But one of the definitions of politics, actually, is that it's something that needs collaborative solutions or community-based solutions. And so this is why I think that we as consumers are certainly encouraged, and we see this in commercials all the time, we're encouraged to buy green and to take the environment into account in our consumer purchases. But for example, if I decide as a result not to own a car and to bike as much as I'm able to, I'm still going to be breathing all the fumes of other people. So that limits us in our effect in individual approaches. And that's why I think we need to be sure to pursue larger political solutions. And the subtitle of the book that you mentioned, Consuming Schools, the subtitle is Commercialism and the End of Politics. So the concern I have is that these consumer-oriented solutions really bring about the end of politics in the sense that we don't pursue larger solutions collaboratively, and that instead we're each individually expected to solve problems like climate change. Now, the other essay you mentioned, the Canadian Geographic, I mean, obviously this fits all together with the issue of climate change. The concern I had was a gradual change I noticed over the years in the kind of the editorial focus of the magazine. Growing up 20, 30 years ago, I read that every month and was very interested in learning about species and the fragility of ecosystems, mountain ranges, and so on and so forth. What I noticed in the last 2 or 3 years was quite a distinct focus, and I looked deeper into this, and I could see that actually more and more links being established between the oil industry in Canada and Canadian Geographic magazine. And one might think at first, why would they have any interest in this magazine? They have their own strategies for communication. Well, by accessing this magazine, they can not only influence its readership, people that buy the magazine and subscribe to the magazine, but also there's a big component of Canadian Geographic that is educational in its orientation. On their website, they often have lesson plans and activities for geography teachers, but also not just for geography teachers, but for teaching geography to many other ages or even outside of geography courses. So it's certainly the most influential educational source or resource for teaching of geography in Canada. Now, if this publication is then coming under the influence of the oil industry, we have real reason to be concerned about the kind of values and beliefs that Canadians are going to be forming about the state of the natural world in our country. Now, if you look closer, it's the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, is one of the larger groups that's now in a, quote, partnership with this magazine. And they portray themselves as being a nonpartisan group but they do represent the oil industry. Now, one of the things that the education arm of Canadian Geographic has come up with is a program called Energy IQ, which encourages students across the country to learn more and more about energy consumption patterns across the country and energy production and also energy distribution. So I was particularly struck by their attempt to have students learn about Canadian geography through the pipeline distribution network across the country. So instead of learning about mountain ranges and rivers and migratory routes of different species and so on and so forth, the way that I learned geography when I was younger, now instead young Canadians are going to be learning about Canadian geographic through the distribution of pipelines across the country. They put together a giant floor map for teachers. It can fill up most classrooms. It's huge. And details where all of these different pipelines are located. And more recently, I was looking on their website, and I see that they actually have more lesson plans for teachers to teach students about pipelines across the country. And one of the activities they encourage teachers to do is a mock debate, and they provide resources for teachers to help the students do research to prepare for the debate. And all of the resources they provide are coming directly from the oil industry or indirectly through groups like the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. There's no environmentally oriented independent groups like Greenpeace or any other groups like that. So this is really significant. If the values that are being developed by students are so influenced by these kind of activities, then I think we have real reason to be concerned about the influence on future political dispositions of Canadians.
So a couple questions, because I think that's a very good example, and I would sort of say to some of our listeners that they can find that essay online, and it's something that is definitely worth the read, because as I said, it is very topical right now in terms of, say, how we're debating issues in this country. And it's something that sort of gives an understanding about what an engaged and critical citizenry should be like in terms of making sure you do have all the facts and the sort of dangers of how when education is not necessarily as unbiased as it should be. But I also just want to say, too, I liked your definition of politics for this, because I think also when we're sort of looking at the name of the book, when you say commercialism and the end of politics, that, again, is a very provocative title. And so I very, very much like the idea when you're talking about how politics is more of this collaborative space when we make a decision for the whole, or at least trying to benefit the whole as much as we can. And also sort of understanding, too, that comes back to, well, some of the individuals in terms of philosophy that you've looked at and that you cite in your research, whether it be the pedagogy of the oppressed or whether it be somebody like Hannah Arendt, sort of gives this idea that it's definitely being concerned with everyone in the sort of political sphere as opposed to just one or two. But I have two questions, and one is, how did we get to this stage of having this kind of strong corporate involvement, shift in language of talking about commercialism, almost in this way where you are not a citizen unless you are a consumer? How did we come to this in terms of the classroom? And alternately, what can be done about it? What should be done about it?
Well, those are good questions. So how did it happen and what can be done about it are big questions. I'll do my best to kind of pull some major points.
I totally understand it's also not very fair to sort of say, we have 10 minutes to talk about this. Could you offer a complete solution?
Well, I think there's a few main points to consider if we want to think about how we got to where we are. And I would start off by saying that it's no coincidence. It didn't just happen. There might be one approach to understanding this question by just kind of saying it was a natural process, or this is human nature. It's human nature to be selfish. It's human nature to be possessive and to want things. So a lot of people will fall back on the human nature argument. But I think human nature is a very complex thing, and it's very multidimensional. I noticed a strange pattern that when we want to give an explanation for cynical behavior, we are more inclined to point to human nature. But when we see examples of collaborative behavior or empathy or support, we don't always reference that as being an example of human nature. And the same thing is true in the animal kingdom. We like to think sometimes of the animal kingdom as a place where it's a survival of the fittest and looking out for number one and that kind of thing. But actually, there's a huge amount of collaboration that happens between species and between the animal and plant world. There's immense deliberate and accidental collaboration and cooperation happened in nature too. So I think that's another dimension to how we work as human beings. We're not just looking out for number one and endlessly greedy and selfish. We have many different conflicting motivations. So how did this happen that we came about to this? Well, I think if we look in the history of the Western world, at least in the 20th century, one of the defining dynamics is the tension between communism and capitalism. And in the book, I talk about a famous conversation between Khrushchev and Nixon when they really reduced the tension between the two nations to the question about which form of political system would better be able to deliver the goods to their population. And that's essentially what was at stake here. Could communism satisfy its population better than capitalism, or vice versa? Now, certainly we have clear evidence that capitalism won that. But I think it's still more complicated than that. And what happened as a result of the fall of communism is that, in a way, we now have come to believe, well, as Margaret Thatcher and others have said, there is no alternative to the political system we have. Since communism failed and we won, therefore we can just kind of keep on trucking and not reflect on any limitations or problems in our type of political system. I think that's a problem too. Now, to bring it back more directly to consumerism, the idea is that since communism failed, therefore, we must ensure that markets are as free as possible, as unregulated as possible. And more recently, we've seen the idea that corporations can be people too. They have the same legal rights as people. And so they have been liberated as well. So we've liberated the free market, and we've liberated corporations as institutions and now as free people. And another way that we've allowed this to happen too is regarding advertising. There's some jurisdictions where they have very strict limitations on advertising in general and advertising in particular to young kids. But we believe that the market should take care of this and that people should be allowed to pursue their rational self-interest. And so we have very minimal regulations on things like advertising. And as a side note, if you want to look at the size of the economy that's devoted to advertising and branding and marketing in relation to the proportion of the economy that's devoted to education, in the last few decades, you see quite a shift that now advertising has become the new educator. The more money is spent on advertising to young kids than educating them, and what happens to their identity when that happens. But just to keep it more recent, I would say some of these post-World War II events regarding communism versus capitalism and now unfettered capitalism. Now, in terms of what we can do, that's the hardest question, I think. There's certainly no easy solution and no single solution. There's lots of different types of attempts. Some of them I've referred to already. They can be individual type of solutions that we can pursue, whether it be smaller things like light bulbs or bigger things like selling cars and biking instead. I think those are all great and noble and do have an effect, but my concern is that they're limited, their disadvantages become bigger when other people don't pursue them as well. So that's why I think that we need larger political solutions. Now, we've had a change in government in Canada, for example, and they've been quite explicit about changing attitude towards pipelines and towards the oil industry, among other industries. Part of one approach is nationally, at a political level, but also we need international organizations. The United Nations has many subgroups that are involved in this, and unfortunately, like many other aspects of the United Nations, they're very limited in terms of legal authority because the globe is still very much run by national governments at the expense of the United Nations. So we're very limited in pursuing global solutions. I think it's important also to start up advocacy groups. I was involved about 4 or 5 years ago in Toronto in starting a group called the Campaign for Commercial Free Schools. And what we're doing there is trying to limit the role of advertising in the classroom or in other educational contexts. And we've been involved with the Toronto District School Board revising their fundraising policy and their advertising guidelines. So I think there's lots of opportunities for people to get involved in different kinds of community-based organizations that can influence the political process. I think those are the main ones. I do want to ensure that we pursue all of them at the same time. It's not like one of them is going to be adequate. And I think what's most interesting about this question as well is how we react to this issue at a kind of a personal level or at an emotional level. We can experience things like discouragement or overwhelm when faced with big political problems. But so I think another kind of secondary question about this is, what kind of emotional relationship or personal relationship do we have with these political issues that I'm talking about?
Thank you for that very, very concise background, too, as to sort of how we come to this place, because I think sometimes with some of our listeners, because of their age, when we're talking about the Cold War, it may not be something that they're as familiar with and not realize how there's still aspects of that that are very much living history. And your reference to Maggie Thatcher, I think, is a very good one, because I remember when the wall fell and the Soviet Empire failed officially, and the whole idea was that when they talked about a new world order, I remember thinking that in that case, the only freedom that mattered was the freedom to consume. And that's something to sort of consider in these spaces. And then it becomes a kind of confused mixing of how freedom is only defined by being able to consume. And that's something that, of course, goes back to the Cold War and some of the rhetoric around that. And sometimes that was interesting. I mean, talking to someone here who was from the Workforce Labor Board, and he was talking about the history of the automotive industry here and how the success of that is something that can't be disassociated from the Cold War and the rhetoric and how we sort of saw things. So this idea of consumerism also is something that's very nuanced and very complicated. But I also think, too, that when you're talking about what we can do about it, it seems that what you're also, again, coming back to is this notion of an engaged citizenry. Because I think about parents I know who stay in contact with and stay very aware of what's happening in their children's classrooms, or individuals in educational spaces at universities or at high schools who will make their opinions heard in terms of offering a kind of criticality with some of these larger narratives that are being presented, such as you mentioned in Going with the Flow and talking about Canadian Geographic. I guess what I'd maybe also sort of throw out, since we're sort of talking in this space about different sort of economic and socio-political theorists, is that it's more of an idea of how there is still a possibility of factoring change in a way, and it hasn't become something that, say, Morris Berman talks about in his End of America, I believe it's called, where it's kind of like it's all done and nothing can be fixed. There's still the possibility of changing where we're going with this.
Yeah, I think there's a few good points there. Let me just trace back to your earlier point about the Cold War and students perhaps not knowing about it. It's one of the first times I really felt that I was becoming a bit of an older person when I realized that many of my students were born well after the Cold War had ended. And I remember my own university study started that year just as the Berlin Wall came down. There were political science courses in Marxist political economy, and by the time I finished my undergrad, those courses were being offered in the history department. So it was quite an interesting change that happened even during the course of my own undergraduate when current events became offered in the history department instead. So it is kind of far from the experience of students. They obviously live in a different era, maybe more defined by 9/11 than by the Berlin Wall. But that point said, let me just do a brief digression on that. One of the opening points I have in the consumerism book is after 9/11, George Bush was famously said, "We can't let this terrorist stop us from shopping." So I thought that was an extraordinary statement coming from a political leader, that he would see his role as a leader to be encouraging the population to go shopping as a response to grief or loss or fear or disorientation, and to ensure that the population got back to a sense of normalcy in daily life. And that's essentially, I guess, the definition of normalcy in daily life is shopping. So that's so different from the era that preceded it, from the Cold War or anything else beforehand. So that connects to the other point about freedom, this idea that to be free means to be able to do whatever you want to. And that's a very problematic definition of freedom and a very limiting definition of freedom. There are many other aspects to freedom than just kind of arbitrary self-indulgence or arbitrary doing whatever you want. But there's a particular notion of freedom that comes out, and this again is a 20th century phenomenon primarily, that to be free is to be unconstrained or to be unrestricted. I would argue that's not true at all. We're actually only free when we're in community, or we're only free when we are members of a political group or a political organization. And we're free through participation and through involvement rather than through retreat or through isolation or a focus on the self. So again, this is a larger historical question. How did it come to be the case that there's a particular conception of freedom that's dominant in our culture today? And it certainly aligns quite closely with the rise of consumerism. To be free is to be able to buy whatever you want to. And if anything's standing in the way of that, then it should be removed. And you were also talking about labor. And what I find so fascinating as well is there's been a shift not only in the mentality that we think of ourselves being citizens to the mentality of we are consumers. What I think is also interesting is a shift in the 20th century where we no longer really think of ourselves as workers or members of working class. Instead, we think of ourselves as consumers. And if you look at the community or intense community orientation of a lot of unions, that is also something that's under threat because of the individualistic focus of consumerism to such an extent that, for example, people that are members of a working class, if you look at their income, there's surveys that have been done of people that are in the working class, and they shop trying to present themselves as not being a part of the working class. So how is it that people want to kind of distance themselves from that affiliation instead of finding solidarity or companionship or community in being a part of that group? So there are very again, this is a larger question, but there's very powerful forces that are encouraging the population to disassociate from their worker identity and instead to reiterate or reinforce an identity of that comes from shopping. And there's a famous description of an incident when in Europe when some retail workers were on strike and other retail workers were crossing the picket line to go shopping in the stores where they were on strike at. So how did people that are a member of the same working class cross the picket line in order to go shopping? Well, obviously their consumer identity is stronger than their identification with other people that are of the same working class as them. So that's one of the powerful effects of consumerism, that we no longer identify as workers or producers or all the affiliations that come with it. Instead, we think of ourselves as consumers. And this is where the topic you referred to earlier of engaged citizenry, whether it be parents involved in their, what their kids are learning in school, or any of the other examples I referenced earlier of potentials for involvement in politics. This is what it really comes down to. I think our sense of political apathy or that nothing can be done or that these are some problems that are bigger than us or larger than us and we can't contend with, that's also a construct. And how did it come about that we lean towards apathy? I think apathy is not a natural thing either. It's a constructed phenomenon. And how is it that we believe that we have tremendous sense of agency to get what we want as consumers, but then when it comes to changing the political world around us, we have a sense of apathy. That to me is a really puzzling, strange contradiction. And I would say both are, again, equally constructed, and that's the very, very powerful ideological function of advertising, that we are empowered as consumers and disempowered as citizens or as members of a political world. And how does that come about and what can be done about it is really one of my big ongoing research questions. And that's what draws me to education and why I have chosen to spend my career working in a faculty of education. Because I really think that these dynamics that we're seeing today regarding the apathy point I just made and all these others are so evident in the field of education. And also education is really one of the most significant places where they can be addressed and critiqued. And, well, resolved might be a too strong word, but I would say at least engaged and discussed. And I really try to make it the focus of my teaching to provide opportunities for students to think about these issues and to talk about these issues as much as possible. Because my concern is what happens to education if it becomes just another place, another institution that reinforces a consumer identity. I'm really doing my best to prevent that from happening and instead to ensure that education is a place where we can critique these patterns. To elaborate a bit more on this idea of the consumer, a student as consumer, I think it's problematic for so many reasons. One is students expect to get what they pay for, and they may or they may not. What's unique and intriguing about education is that there's a lot of unpredictability in it. You may go to buy a car, for example, and you can do your research online beforehand, and you know the horsepower or you know the speed and safety record and everything, and if it doesn't meet what you wanted from any products, there's a return for refund kind of thing. Now, in education, there's no guarantee that you're going to be learning exactly what you wanted to. In fact, part of education, I would argue, is learning some things that you don't want to, or that at least that you didn't know you needed to know beforehand. So education involves a lot of discomfort and difficulty. Now, one of the things that is definitive of consumerism is the promise of easy solutions, of a commodified solution to any and every problem, that they're all within our scope of solving easily and quickly. In fact, there's even a company, and I'm sure that you can all imagine which one, there's even a company that has a big red easy button, and they even sell that easy button. So there's a whole mentality that comes with consumerism that I would argue is deeply incompatible with what education is all about. When you go take a course, you may encounter opposing worldviews that you deeply disagree with and you may even dislike, and you may have a lot of discomfort about learning. So, for example, I teach in Foundations of Education, at Brock. I teach as a first-year course. Towards the end of the course, I include issues about race and racism in the school system. And a lot of students don't want to learn about that, or they want to say things like, I'm not racist, or I don't know anyone that's racist, or I'm going to go teach in a place where there's only white people, so I don't need to worry about learning about the existence of racism. So there's all sorts of strategies that students can use to avoid learning things that cause them discomfort or confront their values or beliefs. And that's a consumer mentality, to refuse learning these kind of new things. So how do you teach a student who's a consumer something that they don't want to learn or that they're resistant to learning? That's one type of challenge. The other type of challenge is a lot of research has been revealing the way that some subjects, like, for example, math, are taught, is that there's now a growing expectation that not only should learning not disrupt my values and beliefs, but that it shouldn't be too difficult or too upsetting. Now, I'm not advocating that students be miserable, not at all. What I'm saying is that what consumerism makes students even more ill-equipped and less prepared for encountering their own limitations or encountering criticisms from a professor or from their TA or from their teacher regarding things like the quality of their writing, the quality of their ideas, and this kind of thing. So students, I think, have been ill-prepared for encountering that adversity or those kind of setbacks. And that, I think, is largely a result of the expectation that it be consistent with consumer values, that education be just another place where consumerism happens. And I talk about that at some length in a new textbook that just came out with Oxford University Press that focuses on education in Canada. The title is Questioning the Classroom, Perspectives on Canadian Education. The primary target for this is first or second year undergraduate students in Canada. The point I was just making about the whether learning should be easier or not and the role of discomfort, I talk about at quite some length in a chapter in that book called Are Students Becoming Consumerist Learners? So there's many, many ways that I think we can consider the changing identity of students, and this really is one of the most significant. There's many other chapters in the book dealing with forming a civic identity in Canada, issues about school choice, issues about ethics in education, and the reasons we aim to educate people in the first place. This Questioning the Classroom textbook really tries to address many new social issues that are arising in the Canadian context from a perspective of philosophy of education. And I think what I see quite a bit in students is this growing consumer mentality.
Taking it back to an educational space, taking it back to a space that this is where you're learning the tools of how to become a citizen and learning the tools of how to engage in a larger society, that it's good that it happens in those spaces because these are where, theoretically, individuals are learning the skills and learning the sort of responsibilities of what it means and how they can be, as you say, an engaged critical citizenry. The book is called Consuming Schools, Commercialism and the End of Politics. This has been a really enjoyable conversation. Trevor Norris, Associate Professor, Faculty of Education, Department of Graduate and Undergraduate Studies in Education at Brock University, thank you so much for making the time to talk to us.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.